sort of semi-arguing, discussing. Those were the kind of conversations that Bob and I had on Skype before we taped, and it's good to get it on tape, you know?
Yeah, I think so, and I like that you're able to bring in a little bit of Bob perspective for him to consider.
Yeah.
He hasn't heard enough of the Bob perspective to recognize. See, he's doing what he says everyone does. User is content. He said, you know, the last time we talked, his main message is user is content. You fit everything back into your own experience, therefore how could you know how enlightened another person is what he said last time.
Yeah.
So he's taking some of your little Bob perspectives you're dropping on him, and he's stuffing it back into his perspective, and not fully maybe, you know, recognizing all of the implications of the Bob perspective. But nevertheless, he's still getting down to the crux of the biscuit, which is, you know, who is it that wants to survive? I mean, for him, that's what the bottom line is, regardless of whether it's human beings or machines or what have you.
Yeah, now, remember, some of the Bob perspective I always bring into people is the McLuhan thing, because nobody knows it, and it's always useful to test them on that. But remember, in my quadrophenia, I can go from Thompson to McLuhan to LaRouche to Croker to myself. He's the Thompsonite. He's talking the Thompson stuff. So that if he actually said McLuhan stuff to me of his own initiative, I could take his view and say it back at him. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I thought this after the conversation. I said, McLuhan was saying that the new environments are new symbolic languages or new symbolic environments.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Carr is just talking about logocentric thought and written thought and in the oral tradition. That's an older medium or an older symbolic environment. I'm trying to point out, well, look, we got these new symbolic environments that you cannot track the standards of the old symbolic environment onto. People, he thinks at bottom, the fact a person wants to keep living is the real reason they're watching TV. He's not getting the fact that, no, TV is a total wise Buddha in everybody's home that everybody's swimming in when they want to.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I almost wanted to interrupt you guys, but I didn't want to interrupt, but it just was, you know, I was sitting there thinking to myself when he was saying that, you know, everybody, you know, when they get a little something, they want to go they want to be someplace where they're not. And, you know, I was thinking, well, I can be somewhere I'm not anytime. All I have to do is pick up the phone and talk to Bob Carr and Bob Dobbs, and I'm somewhere I'm not. All I have to do is go flip on the TV. My chemical body doesn't have to leave the house, and I can be anywhere I want to anytime.
That's right. Like he's still thinking in the consumerist 19th century hardware. People will get on.
But what he was saying, I think, is true about in terms of people's relationship to money. I've experienced that myself when I've had a little extra money that I wanted to stash aside for a rainy day, rather than using it in, you know, for something useful that I could, you know, use it for today or something, or sharing it with other people, whatever.
Right.
The things he's saying are not untrue.
Right, but they remain within cliches. And your point about being discarnate, we need to bring the images of that into our discourse of the sages, because Bob is still using the old images of, at most, you get on a plane. He doesn't know that the search for the experience happens when a guy in the next door to him just turns on the radio, you know, and he's transported by the radio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I think he just sees it as more consumerism, and that it's essentially, bottom line, no different than any other form of consumerism. The consuming information off the TV or...
Yeah, he brings it back to the monad or Thompson's dyad. He keeps it simple.
I mean, for instance, you know, if what he was saying, I can't evaluate this because I never met UG, and I don't, you know, they say when a pickpocket meets a holy man, all he sees are pockets. So I don't even, if I'd met UG, I don't know if I would have seen in UG what Robert Carr sees in UG. But if in fact there's a guy who lives in a continuous state of unbroken joyfulness, and, you know, a sense of that kind of liberation. I'd trade that for McLuhan knowledge or anything. I mean, what else could anyone want?
That's right. That's what I mean, you met UG, you met me. I'm a guy who fits his description, and exactly. I emit joy and freshness all the time. So does Carolyn.
Yeah.
You know,
well, you're the closest I've met. I'll say that.
Yeah, to that kind of whatever he's talking about.
That's yeah.
Right. I mean, there are other people like me, but I'm there at the in the elite class, if you want to call it that. You know what I mean? Because I can go in a park bench. We meet it every week on the beach. Go sit in a park bench, and the person will start pouring their life out. We got it on tape.
Yeah. But I listened to that Willows tape that I thought was pretty interesting. You were in the audience, and Nelson Thal and Matt was in the audience, and
that's Nelson Jr.
Well, that was Nelson Jr. It wasn't Nelson Thal.
No,
I was wondering what Nelson Thal was doing there, since you guys are all enemies. And
yeah, no. First of all, you normally wouldn't be able to hear that because that's private. But you can go into where Matt put it.
Right.
Yeah, because I was looking at it last. I was cleaning up my emails and said, okay, I got that there. Now, where did I put it? Did I screw that up? Let me just think. Just a second now. Willow's audio. I was looking at it, or I saw the list, and I said, shit, I don't know how to do that. I said, I don't go into the FTP thing anymore. I have to do it enough to remember. So we haven't done it in months. So you'll have to show me how, where to go. I think it was on Firefox, but without getting into it, I was thinking about that yesterday, and is that when you were listening to it yesterday, when I looked at the listing?
No, I listened to it a while ago.
Okay, so that's in October 2007 at George Reynolds' home. And George is a millionaire, multimillionaire. It's a 25,000-square-foot mansion. And the guy came, Dave, whatever his name is, came, and he did it there, and there was Matt Shepard, or Sleeper, and his wife, me. Now, I brought young Nelson Thal. And George, Matt, I don't think George's wife was there. That was about it. But Nelson Thal Jr. doesn't say a word.
No, yeah, that's funny. Nelson Thal's take is being unassuming and just being the observer. That's weird. And what's he doing there anyway? So now I know.
Right. Now, how did you know he was even there? Did we mention people's names?
Yeah. Somebody said, Nelson, do you have any questions? And he said,
right.
No, I'm just here to observe.
Now, you're not to know that you heard him. He doesn't want anybody to know that he went to a medium.
Who, Nelson Jr.?
Nelson Jr. Does not want it known that he goes to the Willows.
Right.
That's confidential. But the thing is, let's go back to the shock of you hearing it. What did you were making a comment on what they said. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, they gave you a little bit more of a human side, Bob. They said that you were a bit of a paranoid, you know, kind of looking over your shoulder and stuff. I mean, I'm saying you've got your own personal boogeyman, just like everybody else.
Well, that's if you believe them. I mean, that what happened is that guy came into our George's home. He did not know anything about me, and I don't know if that was him speaking unconscious, but assuming if it wasn't, he came in, and I had given George the cover, the Only Man Alive, you know, Paranoia magazine.
Right.
And it was sitting there on the kitchen counter, and we talked to this guy, David, for like 45 minutes. George and everybody got to know each other. There was the magazine. I wouldn't be surprised that he projected that image into his mind or the Willows picked it up, because I don't go around being paranoid. I mean, you could think that if you heard me on the radio, but I don't. And
well, they said that, you know, your mind is always is busy to the point where you get yourself, you know, sometimes tied up. I mean, one of the things...
What did they say? I haven't heard the audio. I don't remember.
Okay. One of the things that I learned about in the Enneagram, you know, you have a physical type, an emotional type, and a mental type. And mental types sometimes get so abstracted in their thoughts that they start to get abstracted from being grounded in the physical world, and that can lead to a sense of feeling paranoid or fearful. And I thought that they were indicating that that was something that a little pitfall that you fall into.
They're wrong. I don't agree totally with the Willows. They're wrong. I'm not that. I don't think at all. I just repeat myself all the time.
Uh-huh.
There's different variations, but I don't carry thought very far.
Yeah.
You know, no, I'm not paranoid. I'm not any of that stuff. So that's why it's interesting how they were kind of wrong.
And it was interesting to me that you're even there seeking their counsel if they have these limitations and they're not even accurate. Why are you even there paying for their time?
I didn't pay. I chipped in, but I was there because Matt requested me to be there.
Oh, okay.
I didn't.
But you turned Matt on to the Willows. It was your find to begin with.
No, here's what happened. In the summer of 2007, a woman, a client of Carolyn, someone she didn't know, first-time consultation from Toronto, Carolyn always asked the people, what doctors did you have before? What had been previous diagnoses? You know, get their history, patient history. And the woman was saying this, I learned that, or someone told me this, another doctor did that. And then I went, the Willows say this. And Karen goes, the Willows, what are they? And they say, well, they're medium that, they come through a medium that the Evergreens recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol said, oh, I know about the Evergreens. So the woman was surprised Carol knew about the Evergreens, didn't expect that. So I don't know how much more she described the Willows, but unbeknownst to me, Carolyn was interested in something that the Evergreens seemed to support, according to this woman. Turned out to be not accurate later. But so she had a reading. I didn't even know about it.
Hmm.
So then after it, she told me, and she showed me, she types everything real fast, so she showed me the transcript of what she typed during the reading, and where she was waiting for the tape, which I would eventually could hear. But I read her transcript, and I said, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to have a reading. So I called them up, and I booked one, and a week or so later, I had a reading. And that was in July, or 1st of August, 2007, I think. And I was only semi-interested in what they said. I didn't think they were as good as the Evergreens. So I was a little suspicious. So then I told Matt about it, and he had a reading, and he was really impressed. And he told me about some ESP they had, there were six people, three couples, I think, who went to it. So I thought, oh, that's good. And when Carolyn heard that he liked it, Carolyn said, that's good. They got their Evergreens. You know, it's good for the next generation to get something like the Evergreens. So I wouldn't think they're equal. So that was that. And I didn't want to have another reading from them. But when I got to Toronto, Matt told me he wanted to have a private reading with the Willows. And he had played an excerpt for George Reynolds, and George was interested. He even asked the Willows for the Willows' impression about George. And they indicated accurately what he was, as we know George. And then George heard it. Matt played it for him. And George heard it and said, yeah, it's true. I'm mostly an asshole, is what the Willow said. And so he agreed. He thought, well, that's accurate. So Matt is telling me that he and that George was a bit interested, but Matt wanted to have a reading. And then he thought, and this is my first night in Toronto. I'm staying overnight in last October. And he says, you know, I want you to be there, Bob. And I said, okay. So he called up George, and he said, do you want to be part of this? And he said, okay, I will. So shall we do it at your place? Yeah, we can do it at our place. So we all gathered at George's, and I was kind of indifferent. And so I went through the motions of having a reading, but I never was totally impressed with them. Wasn't great. I liked the idea that they were, almost 300,000 entities versus the 7,000 entities at the Evergreens. You heard that part, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you asked them, and then they kind of hesitated for a moment and then came up with this figure. But, you know, so they pull a figure out of their hat. What does that mean?
But the figure is a lot greater than...
Yeah, I know, but did they do that to impress you, or is it true? There's no way to measure an answer like that.
Right. Well, anyways, within the game of listening to them, it was impressive. They had a lot more. And they then explained that they come from the same place as the Evergreens, they're a different straw. Each comes from the same milkshake, but there's different straws into the milkshake, and so their straw had 300,000 entities, and the Evergreens had 7,000. So I thought that was interesting that they were bigger. And that was that.
But you talked with every significant person that ever lived on this planet through the Evergreens. So who do they have? What kind of numbnuts do they have as part of their collective anyway?
Wait a minute. What are you saying?
They must have all the people who turned out to be slaves ended up in their camp, because you talked to every significant person that ever lived on the planet through the Evergreens. So who's left to even be part of their group?
That's right.
I mean, if you talk to Tesla, Einstein, Edison, and every fucking buddy else through the Evergreens, then who's left for their stupid group anyway?
Yeah, but you're mistaking it. Einstein, McLuhan, these people were not part of the Evergreens.
Oh.
The Evergreens would bring them in. Okay?
Oh, I see.
So, you know... Well,
what part of group were they? Was McLuhan part of a group, or is he his own group?
The Evergreens could get you anybody you wanted. So if I asked for McLuhan, they'd bring him in.
Mm.
Okay, so they were not, I don't know who the Evergreens historically were. It didn't matter. They say in their published explanation of what they were or are, they say, we are saints and sinners just like you. You know,
mm-hmm.
A lot of criminals, a lot of saints, just normal souls.
Oh.
So it's not that they had McLuhan and the Willows didn't. The Willows had the same access. What was disappointing about the Willows, I asked to talk about McLuhan, and they basically said they didn't do that, couldn't do it, or something.
Oh.
They said I'd just get a tape recording.
Oh, okay.
So that's what diminished the Willows for me. I couldn't continue talking to them. They didn't encourage it.
Right. Well, and also, if they gave you a version of McLuhan that didn't match up with the version you were getting with the Evergreens, then you'd have to start questioning who's being authentic and who's not.
That's right. Well, a lot of what the Willows said in my first reading was the opposite of the Evergreens.
Yeah.
I went through a lot of the archetypal questions, and they had different answers than the Evergreens. Mm. You know, really different, opposite.
Oh.
So they didn't agree. So...
How does that leave you feeling? You must feel very ambiguous, because you don't know who's telling the truth or if there even is a truth.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a given. I'm like Bob Carr. I don't care. But within the game of having conversation and having a little experience, I thought that they weren't as good as the Evergreens, and that I would trust the Evergreens more on what their interpretation of events were than the Willows.
Right.
I feel that the guy's personality comes through the Willows.
Yeah.
Personality. But anyways, what happened, though, is that we had that second session. So I heard Carolyn's tape, or it never got to us, but I think they got lost, and then only my tape showed up. But at least I know what Carolyn's was said. And then I heard mine, and then I heard the one with the group at George's. Then, a few weeks later, Nelson Jr. wanted to have a private session with the Willows where he would talk without anybody knowing what he was saying, and he wanted me there. So I went to that one with him.
Oh.
And that's the one where the Willows declared me the leader of the revolution. You remember? You know that story, right?
Yeah. I thought that was Walter Boert that said that, but that was the Willows, huh?
Yeah, well, Boert talks about something else. This is back in November, and it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I let Nelson ask all his questions, and this one, I just waited, and then it was time for us to talk, me to talk, and I don't know what I went into, but at one point, I picked up the theme from the George Reynolds session that you heard about how people are dumb. I mean, Willows were a bit worried about the dumbing down that was going on. Was that in your session that you heard?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I picked up on that theme and asked them about it, and they said, well, you Nelson Jr., your generation ain't going to have time to fix this problem. You know, when you guys take over in 30 years,
mm-hmm.
35, 40 years, it's too late. He said it can only be corrected by the baby boomers,
mm-hmm.
and the baby boomers, they blew it, they were idealistic and all that, but they blew it, and they better get their act together and get back on track, we're in real trouble. That's
mm-hmm.
what the Willows were saying. So I said, I don't know what I said, but then they said, you know, Nelson Thal and his generation would respond to the baby boomers if the baby boomers started being better, quote, better, idealistic or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wells then said, now, Bob, they'll respond, and we want you to lead. And I thought to myself, well, I need a lead today. And then they kind of picked up on it, and they said, we don't want you to be a general leading an army. Just start gathering people together of like mind,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be it. So mm-hmm. Does this sound familiar? Did I tell you that before?
Yes.
Yeah. So I thought that was cute that they said I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And Nelson Thal represented the young generation who would support me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because the young kids, they kind of know everything's fucked up. They go through what the baby boomers learn faster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And makes them maybe more cynical, too. So so in February, Nelson was going to have another reading. And meanwhile, okay, they said that in November, and I wasn't on the radio. I was doing nothing publicly. Occasionally Evan Ray's show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing dramatic. And then by January, though, I'm on James's show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, here I am out doing some public stuff. And so in February, March, Nelson was telling me about his next reading he was going to have, and we were going over some questions he should ask. And I said, well, ask him how I'm doing in my revolution. And one of us, both of us, I don't know which, said, yeah, they're probably going to go, the fucking faggot blew it.
Mm.
that was our joke response, right?
Right.
The fucking faggot blew it. And so then he had the reading, and after I said, well, how'd it go? What happened? Was I a fucking faggot? They said, no, everything's going along great. And so then what happened, the James Show got a bit bigger, and then we got on Achieve Radio, and then all this Dobbstown.com started happening. We in Hawaii, and anyways, my media profile has gone up. And,
yeah, all the video, the buzz, the videos and stuff.
Yeah. Who would have thought that a year ago? You know, so I think the Willows might have something. They might know something, and they knew I'd be doing something, and they gave me a big framework for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they may be highly intuitive in the sense that everyone has an intuition. They may be highly intuitive and then able to sort of sculpt their little message around their intuition, even though the details of their message may not be right, or it may be filtered through the channel's biases. There may be that, you know, they pick up on some essence or something.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You listen to, you see how you, the danger of oral, immediate oral transmission. You heard our session.
Mm-hmm.
And you assumed that I wanted to be there, and you projected those levels into it, you know, which is natural. You project what you assume led to the situation.
Yeah, because you had told me about your interest in the Willows previous to my hearing this, and that you were scoping them out, and you weren't, you know.
But I wasn't. I only scoped them out for one reading, and then by coincidence, I end up on this next one with Matt, and then another one with Nelson. I've never ask them for another reading.
Yeah.
You know, cause
but
not,
they found out about the Willows through you. Otherwise, they never would have found out. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm not out of bounds by making the assumptions that I made, but then I get it cleared up because I'm, you know, willing to go into it with you and ask you about it.
Yeah, like you don't know that I'm thinking that they're not accurate about me. Because they said that about me, I don't know if that's accurate.
Well, I know you didn't. You didn't respond to them in the affirmative. You didn't disagree,
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, at one point you just kind of laughed, and the energy kept moving on, and you didn't seem to. I wasn't sure if you were laughing because you felt embarrassed and you just wanted to get off the subject, or if you really that was how you felt at the moment. Because they even went so far. This was maybe, I thought probably a little bit of maybe pettiness on the part of the channel, but you had made some kind of comparison between yourself and George, and they said, well, that's because you wish that you were George, or that you could be like George, or something like that, you know.
Yeah, there was a whole thing I brought up.
Uh-huh.
That I knew would be controversially.
Oh, I know. You asked if, you said that when George had his reading with the Evergreens, he asked if he could see the boss.
Right.
And they said, and then the boss came through and it blew George's mind.
Yeah.
And then you said, could you do that? And they said, well, you'd have to consult the channel about that.
Yeah.
We couldn't make that decision for him, but if he says yes, then yes, we could do that.
Yeah, now George didn't know I'd bring that up, and he actually probably was...
He didn't want to go... He either, for whatever reasons, either because he had personal reasons he didn't want to go into it, or because he wanted to remain as the observer and not contaminate the message, he didn't volunteer to go into it.
That's right. He probably was. He seemed to me across the room a little irritated that I did this.
Yeah.
This stuff without him.
That was my experience.
Yeah. So I think he was irritated, and I didn't know. Who knows why he was irritated? But yeah, he was irritated, and I knew I was taking. It was risky bringing this personal thing into it, but I did it, and that led to. This is what was interesting. After that reading, we told Dave about this. No, we didn't. Not in front of George. When we were when Nelson wanted to have another reading, we called Dave up and we.
Dave who?
The medium.
Yeah.
Forget his last name. We called him up and we told him what we did about the George's thing and how the Willows said, well, you'd have to ask Dave. So we asked Dave, could you let us try to get a higher Willows? And he said, sure, I've never done that before or anything, but we can do that. So he gave us permission. So when we were at his mother's home with the private session with Nelson and on November 2nd, and we did that. We did 45 minutes with the Willows 1, we'll call it, and then we went to Willows 2, and the readings were only about an hour and a half long, but we went an extra half hour, so it was a total of 2 hours. But we had a pretty interesting reading with the Willows 2. And Nelson was pretty impressed. So we actually did what happened to George, if we believe the Willows. And so that's...
Well, what happened to George was it felt like, you know, like the laser beam came down from the UFO and struck him in the top of the head and stunned him or something. I mean, I don't think you could have missed it. If the Willows did what the Evergreens did, I don't think you'd have a question in your mind. It sounds to me like you're not sure.
Yeah, we never got zapped. Like George said that for the few minutes that he was in touch with the higher Evergreens, he was in another world. And when it stopped... When they withdrew and he felt and they came back to Evergreens One, he felt that he fell back into a dream.
Mm.
That where he'd been for 3 minutes was so real, it was incredible.
Yeah,
we never get any of that when we went to Willows Two. But what was interesting is that I'd been given instructions by David to bring him out of trance. So we end the session. We're into the Willows, the advanced Willows. We're talking to them. And it's time to end. So I get him out of those Willows. There was a pause, and he never woke up. And then somebody said, you have to get him out of the Willows 1. And I'd forgotten. Oh, yeah, there was two levels. So we had to take him out of two phases. You know what I mean?
Oh.
So that was funny that I thought I brought him out, but he wasn't coming out. And then I had to realize, oh, no, we just got him out of the advanced Willows. Now we got to get him out of the normal Willows.
Right.
And so that actually was, if they were faking it, that was a good fake. They remembered. He would have come out of trance, and then I would have thought later, years later, wait a minute, I forgot to take him out of the second level. That means they faked coming out of this second level. But no, they pointed out that they were on a level, and I had to bring him out of that level. So that was pretty real.
Yeah. Well, did you ever ask George what he thought of the Willows?
Oh yeah, he heard the tape of Matt, and he said he agreed with me. Matt told him what I said. I said they're not the Evergreens, but they're B grade, B level,
mm-hmm.
Not A level, B level. But that's very high compared to most media, most
yeah.
mediums. And Matt, after George heard the Willows tape, Matt told him what I said, and George says, "Yeah, I agree with Bob. That's what they are. They're not the Evergreens, but they're pretty good."
But that's also based on his was that his initial experience with the Evergreens?
From the tape.
From
then
the tape,
he experienced
yeah.
them in his home, okay?
Right.
And he didn't seem to want to pursue it after. I think he kind of said, no, they'll still be great. He was not more impressed.
What more can you get after you've had 100 readings with the Evergreens?
That's right. Well, he's had 500 readings with the Evergreens.
Oh, my God.
He had a big company, and he gave readings. He got employees or friends to do and about another 500, and he heard every one of those readings because these people wanted to see what he thought of their own particular reading.
Wow.
And then there's 500 public readings, approximately. So he's heard 1,500 readings.
Yeah.
And what was great, he's the one who digitized, his son had digitized the equipment in the basement of their mansion. So he digitized all my audio cassettes, but also in exchange for him hearing all my readings, I got to hear a lot of his readings.
Yeah.
Which were pretty interesting. I asked stuff that he would never think of asking, and he asked stuff that I never thought of asking or didn't want to ask. I might have thought of it, but I didn't bother going into it.
Right.
So I learned a lot from his readings. He learned a lot from mine. And we had a great meeting of evergreen knowledge, the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
His company makes Provide.
Oh, okay. What's that?
You know, the supplement that's mentioned on Carolyn's site.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought.
That's interesting. You heard the Willows thing. Yeah, you're the only person in the world who heard it outside of who was there.
Right. Well, that was fun.
It
was fun to listen to.
Yeah, I would say not. It probably, I don't know. Nelson Jr. They did some interesting things with him. He reported to be what they said. His own sessions when I wasn't there later, once I'd come back to New York.
Right.
And there were some interesting glimmers. I think they got something going there. Now, one thing, he had a session in September, end of September, and they told him that on October 7th there would be a massive terrorist incident, which I think they might have said would be designed for to influence the election. And that would be a week after Nelson heard this, and he told me, and so we waited, and it didn't happen. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
They have said that, they said Obama would win. They said that the oil cartel arranged for Obama to win. They knew that the Bush image had ruined America's face image around the world, and that fucked up business from the oil cartel's point of view. Caused a crimp in their international business. And I've used this on James' show.
Right.
Just threw it in. And they said the oil cartel purposely made the Republican candidacy a dumb candidacy.
Yeah. Well, when I heard that thing where what's the guy's name who does international connection? Doug somebody. But Greg Duffel. Yeah, he played that clip of those two French comedians who called her.
Yeah.
And I was floored. I mean, I thought to myself, this woman is a total kiss ass. I mean, she couldn't. How could? My God, could you imagine her president? I mean, I thought, how could they run such a shallow person for, you know, one heartbeat away from the presidency? I mean, obviously, if that's the best they could do, they're in bad shape. But you're saying that they did that intentionally because they wanted to throw the election.
Yeah, and they wanted to make the election. The Willows didn't say this, but this is what I developed from it. They, taking what the Willows said, then thinking that she was the perfect person to at least energize the Republican base, a small part of the base or half of it, so that it looked like the Republicans weren't throwing it. You had to make it real, and she was the perfect solution to that.
Right, she was the perfect image for the idiots that want that image.
Yeah, and so she could energize them, and so the Republicans would think that they were in the race. And my Secret Counsel 10 friend said, did you notice that McCain, when he gave his speech, a concession speech, there was a smirk in his face? Like, I'm glad I don't have this job. This mess is coming. Like this Secret Counsel 10 friend told me before during the debate. He said, I don't know why McCain just in the first debate says, Obama's the best guy for the job, I concede, because it would be stupid to be president at this point. So McCain never wanted it.
And yeah, I know everybody talked about how gracious he was when he in his
yeah,
speech.
I know, but I never saw the footage, but my friend saw it, and he says you could see a smirk, a cynical smirk. As he,
I don't know. I think I would have to say that your friend is projecting, because it wasn't his speech. Actually, his turning over, you know, the reins of power to Brock. He actually was quite eloquent and was generous. But then, you know, it made you wonder if he wasn't also happy. But
he was happy, Greg. He was
relieved.
Eloquent. He was natural because it was his real feelings.
Yeah.
I don't want it, he said. Hey, I'm glad you're
taking
it.
Yeah. But I think there's
anyways,
no, you know, evidence for a smirk is sketchy, because I watched it.
Well, this guy, C. Constantine, would know what's going on.
Yeah.
So he could see something you couldn't see. So the Willow said that...
Well, wait a minute. You know what, Bob? Your Secret Council of Ten guys aren't too spot on, because you suggested to me... First of all, you said McCain was going to win, and you held out almost to the very end that they were going to pull the strings, the levers of manipulation, and they were going to get him in.
No, I only said that. I never have an opinion on it.
Well, you stated it on the cash flow show, and you even suggested it to me 2 days before the election.
Yeah, well, you're mixing up several things. I will say that just if someone thinks that Obama is going to win, I'll throw in the other thing to make them think. The whole point of my agenda is to make you think and doubt what you think you know. I'm in the Bob Carr School. But I know what you're referring to, the Jimmy Carter dark horse, but there was another point. I knew Obama was going to win to the degree I would know from the Willows. I mean, that was...
Well, you can't trust the Willows. You have to make up your own mind based on what's going on in what your gut feeling is watching the media and the whole thing unfold. I mean, it became apparent to me that he was going to win. I never had really any concerns about it at all, unless they were able to tamper with the voting machines.
Right, but here's the thing. You're saying if one followed it, I don't, like I say, I don't think. I don't watch the media. I know nothing about what's going on. The way what you consume, I have no experience of.
Mm-hmm.
I knew nothing about the election, who was winning or whatever. Whatever anybody said, I'd throw in a ridiculous anti-environmental pattern. That's all I do. I'm a pattern interrupter. It's based on nothing. If anybody pressed me, they said, well, what are your sources? I don't have any. I got this from a medium, I'll say.
But you should know what's going on, because your Secret Council of Ten guys apparently are running the world.
Yes, and we do not occupy ourselves with as trivial things as a local election.
Oh.
It's so irrelevant to what's going on. Now, here's the thing. To the degree that I juggle...
Local election, this is a planetary event.
No, it's a local election.
Not the White House is the word makes the market for the planet.
No, for the TV body, which is only one quarter of the body. See, now you can start realizing what I mean. I know most people have a clue what I'm talking about, even if they can say the language. You forgot. It's just the TV body.
Well, it's the TV body for the world now. It's not just the TV body for the United States.
The world is puny.
In other words, the White House...
Listen to this. The world is puny compared to the chip landscape. The chip landscape swallows all those galaxies that Bob Carr is...
You can't even call it a landscape. It's invisible. A landscape implies visual bias.
Right. That's right. It's bigger. It's bigger.
You can't use words like bigger. It doesn't have spatial boundaries.
That's my point. It's bigger than the universe, because it doesn't have any dimensions. All right? The universe is bigger.
I don't know. You have to find another word. More pervasive or something, or more omnipresent.
Swallows it. The chip swallows the huge universe.
Yeah, for our little local sector of the galaxy that we're in here, and this tiny little portion of...
No. It swallows... We are bigger than the huge universe when you have the chip landscape. That's what you got to remember. The television cancels space and time. That's not just local space and time. It's the universe of space and time.
Mm-hmm.
For the anthropomorphic experience of reality, that's the fact. But let's go back to the thing is, so the Willows, to the degree I even cared about it, I said, oh, the Willows said Obama's going to win. Okay, that probably is true. The Willows probably have a little intuition. They're not as good as the Evergreens. but they can know something. So I knew
the evergreens were worthless in terms of prediction. You told me that they would throw curveball predictions because they didn't want to be perceived as knowing what was going on.
Look, they did 11,000 readings, I think it is. They said things in different situations. They were always right about the elections, most of the time. Sometimes they weren't right to me, but they might have been right to someone else. They were right some of the time. Right.
Well, you're either right or not. Your candidate either moves into power or he doesn't.
Well, see, you're forgetting. They were around for 30 years. They dealt with 30 years of elections.
Yeah.
And they were right about the year 2000. I knew Bush, to the degree I believed the evergreens, I knew Bush was going to win no matter what. And he did win, no matter what.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But to go back to what you're citing is when I told you I spoke to Bill. That's what I call him, right? To you? I call him Bill.
Who's Bill?
Oh, the Secret Council 10 guy.
Right, Bill, yeah.
I've used that word.
The guy who's surrounded by a 25-mile perimeter of security.
Yeah. If I called him Bill with you?
When we were at Tariq's place, yeah.
Yeah. So Bill said to me 2 days before, and this is what I said to you. He said, who's going to win? And he said, well, it'll be a Jimmy Carter. And I said, what do you mean Jimmy Carter? He says, a guy who comes out of nowhere. So that was about all we said. So I was thinking later, a guy who comes out of nowhere, that's John McCain. In terms of right now, because he was behind.
Yeah.
And that's what I told you. That's where you got the impression that it was John McCain, because I thought he meant John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to him later after election. He says, no. He said, I meant by Jimmy Carter the fact that Obama, 4 years ago, was a state senator. Mm-hmm. And then he only had 143 days as a global senator. Federal senator, and he then now is president. And he said he spent $205 million to get a $400,000 a year job. So it turned out that he meant that Obama was a dark horse.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. That's what he meant. But I didn't know that's what he meant.
Yeah, he was a dark horse a year ago, but he hasn't been a dark horse for the past 4 months.
Right, so that's what I was thinking he meant. So he meant Obama. So if you say that I predicted McCain and that guy predicted McCain, I'm correcting your impression there. He meant Obama. As a matter of fact, he had told me the night before the election that he was very happy, and he didn't tell me what he was happy about, but in retrospect, he probably... He probably figured out or something. It might have had something to do with Obama, but I'm not sure because that's just a puny level. But I know the day after the election, he met with Warren Buffett. And then the next day, Warren Buffett was announced as part of Obama's economics transition team.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned this to Bill. I said, so Buffett got the word from you, because the guy I'm talking about, this Bill, is the real president of the United States. He owns the United States. I said, so Buffett came and got the word from you about what to tell Obama? And he says that I can neither confirm nor deny that statement.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what he often says when he can't say something. So I don't know what he was happy about the day before, but it might have been Obama, it might have been this. I do know... that when we met about 2 months ago, we were planning our meeting in Kansas and all that we were going to do and the revolutionary thing we were going to do. And he says, this was after the economic collapse in September. So it might have been the third week of September. He says, we don't have the supposed enemies we'd be up against to do what we're going to do. They ain't there anymore. And I said, yep. So... I think it's been getting happier and happier because they've been getting whoever the enemies could be. They have disappeared, and I take that as all symbolic because the Rye principle canceled out in the Android meme world over the last few months, and at the same time we had the Rye article in Paranoia magazine. So, on a major
he's not level. Talking about enemies at the level of terrorism, is he?
No, no, we're talking about competitors in power.
Mm-hmm.
What
people that could obstruct his ability to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, or our group. It's not just him, it's a group. And it's what Bob Marshall says now. I mentioned this. I've told him some of this stuff. And in passing, he now says as a code word, joke word, weak trillionaires. And I would say, in reference to you, yes. I'm talking about the weak trillionaires because our team is a quadrillionaire, five quadrillionaire group. And so the guys that are weak, they're just trillionaires. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So Bob Marshall has this joke. Yeah, you remember me saying it, so he takes my tone and he puts it on. He goes, yeah, they're just weak trillionaires.
Well, when we were at Tariq's place, I thought you indicated that the real wealth was in China.
Well, that's the one step of it. That's one part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, you know, if Bill was happy on Monday, and then Obama gets in on Tuesday, just today or this weekend, China announced that it released a lot of money. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Put in $500 billion for infusion in their economy. Now, they're saying right now that it didn't help the stock market, but that's probably not relevant. The point is that China released their money after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be something there. And that brings up you wrote this thing. Maybe I deleted it. You said... Halloween is over, Bob.
Right.
And you're showing this picture. You don't believe that Lewinsky is a Israeli agent, right? That's what you're making fun of.
She was so ditzy, she could barely be a credible secretary, much less a implant from the Mossad.
All the assassins are ditzy. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan. The point is, if you bring in the group of knowledge that Boert started, the MK Ultra assassination zombies, then the person would be ditzy if they're subject to hypnosis. Okay, so.
Yeah, but how do you seduce a president unless he would have been, he could have been seduced by anybody? It doesn't make sense, Bob. Why would she have any better chance of seducing the president than any of the women on his staff who totally were goo-goo eyed over the most powerful man in the world that they got to stand next to and work with?
You should stop these silly phrases. The most powerful man in the world. That's why.
No, I'm saying from their eyes, from the perspective of these adoring women who worked in and around the office.
What?
Any woman could have had the power to seduce him.
Right, and they did. Many women. He screwed everybody. The point is that the one that became public is the program one.
Mm.
Okay? So here's the thing.
It is kind of weird that they ended up with a piece of her clothing that has his sperm on it.
Yeah,
I mean, that almost sounds too like a setup right there.
Yeah, look at this way, Scott. You have a frame of reference that you think is solid, or more solid than the others. You don't put your own frame reference equal to the other improbable ones, because you need to do that. You need to look at what Hennigan says.
Well, look, Bob, now that I'm going into it with you a little bit more, it seems a little more credible. But getting it from his website does not seem credible, because first of all, his website looks like he, first of all, he's running, he has all kinds of weird little links on his website that you don't see that are reporting information to these advertising companies and stuff like that. He's using this website as a ways of making money, number one. Number two, he's doing caricatures of the people that he's slinging accusations at. And number three, his fucking website, he was predicting that McCain was going to win and all these things. things were going to happen, and he's fucking wrong. And then when Obama gets in, now he's got a whole new thing that he's doing. I mean, why should anybody trust that guy's website?
Look, we're going to get a lot more talked about. It's very easy to understand your point within three words, Scott. So try to hear how I want to respond to the 10 points you made. First off, he was right down to the end. He said it was indecisive whether it be Obama or McCain. He said that. All right, he didn't say McCain would win. He said it was indecisive. He didn't know who was going to win. He thought they were both useful. And many other things he says are accurate. There's other parts that aren't accurate. What he is, he's a collage of Skolnick, Chris Story, and his own particular work for Albert, for Gore. So he has his own background, plus you know the derivatives are Skolnick and Chris Story. He takes a LaRouche view of Chris Story. Since Chris Story is pro the Queen, then Tom Hennigan sees a role for himself. Well, we're Americans, we're against the Queen. The Queen's really a bad person, so we don't trust Chris Story on that point. We use the other part of Chris Story's stuff that fits into the American paradigm. So you have to know these subtleties, and that comes from reading it and studying what he's doing to figure out his ripples. So you haven't read enough of it to know what he's right or wrong on. He never said McCain would win. He said it was undecided, to the last minute. And now he's saying that Rahm Emanuel is co-president. And Rahm Emanuel, did you read all the Skolnick stuff on Rahm Emanuel?
No, I only know what I know about him through the media and through what Karen says about him, and she follows politics meticulously.
What did she say about him?
She thinks he's a good guy for the job. He comes out of sort of Chicago mafiosa bulldog political
good,
tactics.
Good guy for the job?
Yeah, for his particular job. She says you point that guy in a direction and let him off the leash, and he goes like a bulldog. He's like a pit bull. He'll get the job done for you. So she goes, I'd want him working for me.
Well, it sounds like she's operating at a fear-based paranoid level. Isn't there going to be a new, better world with Obama, that we don't have to think that way?
Obama's got a he's got to deal with criminal elements that want to attack him and tear him down. So he's got to have a strong force to protect him and to get stuff done that nobody else can get done because they're wimpy, you know, pansy ass or whatever. So he picked a strong guy for that particular job, somebody he could count on to get the job done.
So you think the world would get a better place if it was based on paranoid fear and mafia?
No, but I think that if a guy wants to move in the right direction, he's going to have to...
You can't go in the right direction with your attitude. That
attitude will
lead to a problem.
You know, they put when he gave his acceptance speech kind of thing, they had bulletproof glass around the stage. You know, there are certain precautions you have to take, and
he didn't have a pit bull. He had a machine around him. That's relevant. Not a pit bull guy.
Well, I don't know. See, I don't know enough about politics to.
Yeah, well, just read Hennigan's thing. According to Hennigan, Rahm Emanuel worked for Bush and set up Clinton, but also worked for Clinton in other times.
Right.
And that would be a tetrad manager's position. He would be working some of the time for George, the other time for Bill, and the third time for Obama.
So, right. So you got somebody who knows the game, he knows the landscape, he knows how to get stuff done, and if he's an honorable guy and he follows the command of his president, and he helps the president to get his job done, then he's a good soldier.
Yeah, we don't need soldiers anymore. If you're going to have a new world, you can't operate on fear. It sounds like you say Carol's very knowledgeable because he follows politics.
No, look at the emblem of the United States. It's an eagle. An eagle can fly, but it also has claws, and it can fight. Because it has to be able to stand for a higher moral principle, but it also has to be able to fight for that principle in a world full of chaos and ignorance and really scuzzy people.
Well, if you look at the world that way, you're going to get that kind of world.
Well, that's the kind of world that impinges itself on powerful positions such as the White House. You know, you got greedy, nasty people who want a piece of power, and they're the ones who are pushed, trying to crowd their way to the front of the line. I'm not saying the average person is like that. I have a lot of faith in the average person.
I don't know why you'd have faith in the average person.
Well, the average person, if he has enough to eat and you leave him alone, he's going to be a decent guy. He'll be friendly to you, and he's not going to steal your car.
Well, you can solve that problem by not having a car.
Yeah, I know.
Then you don't have to care whether he's okay or not. So the other thing, it was another... Okay, the Sarah Palin thing. So, that excerpt, that skit that the Montreal guys did, since I never even knew about it, I listened to it. If you notice, I'm listening to it, and I think it's a skit between someone acting. So I go, man, she's a good actress, because... She sounded like, you know, she was being the phony Sarah, you know, to a T. But then by the end of it, I realized, oh, this is really Sarah. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that it actually did happen. I thought it was a fake skit, like a Saturday Night Live thing. Mm-hmm. So then I said to Greg, I've got to re-listen to that and hear it again with the right lens on, because I thought it was an actress. But I didn't have to re-listen to it again to realize how bad Sarah sounded.
Right.
You know, once I realized it really was her and not a skit. I mean, I'd heard a soundbite here and there, so that to me the actress, what I thought was an actress, was doing it correctly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But turned out it wasn't an actress. It actually was her. But once you know that it was her and how over their head she was, then you could see why McCain cynically did not want to be president and brought her in.
Mm-hmm.
You would assume he'd have to go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You're not stupid.
You know, you and I both smiled when we saw that who he picked. I mean, it seemed like a good choice at the time. It's like, oh, maybe he can shake things up here with this bringing her in. Is it what other, you know, who? What was he going to do? Bring in another old fart like himself? That wouldn't have worked. He had to bring in somebody to counterbalance his image.
Yeah,
but you know,
and it worked. It worked for. I mean, when all I ever saw of her was her speech at the her acceptance speech when he brought her in, and that was a good speech within the realm of that world.
Yeah, she had no for
anything. I didn't know anything. But then I read Camille Paglia, who said that within a week she was great, and the feminists should back off. And then I spoke to somebody about a week later, so it was 2 weeks after she got in, and the guys. And McCain was doing well in the polls, but then he told me just that last few days, McCain went down, and he said Obama was back. Now, partly that was due to the economy collapsing, but I found out later that she'd been on Katie Couric, and that she'd blown that interview.
Yeah.
It was probably when she went down, so I didn't know any of that stuff, but suddenly she was doing great the first 2 weeks, and then she was gone.
Yeah.
And so what I had said had worked did not apply later, but I didn't know why it didn't apply.
Right.
I hadn't followed it. Now I know. I mean, just from the commentary now, I eventually, just listening to Greg, I find out what's going on. But the, it was a brilliant move. Matter of fact, I was looking for Camille Paglia column, see if she had a new column where she sort of said, hey, I got duped.
Yeah.
I got duped by this person, but I don't know if she'll admit it. But the first week, when I saw her speak, because I watched that on YouTube, because
mm-hmm.
I thought, hey, this is neat. Person from nowhere coming up and doing this, and is a woman, and is reasonably attractive, was a good move by McCain. But now that we know more about her, you can see that McCain and them set her up.
Yeah, maybe.
And that's what Carol was saying to me yesterday. She said, I wonder if Sarah's...
But you know what, Bob? She, you know, there. It looks like Obama won by a landslide because he got like 350 electoral votes to McCain's 150 electoral votes.
He only got 8 million more.
8 million more popular, you know, actual votes. Yeah, so they got a groundswell of support from the American public.
Yeah, Sarah did. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's because they represented an image of America that people wish that, you know, a lot of frontier.
You're telling me that? You don't need to tell me that. Of course, I know that.
Yeah.
That stuff. The the thing is, no, and probably some people, I don't know, it looked pretty bad, her performances that are on tape now, but there may be a future for her. There, maybe she's, you know, as they were saying that she could, when they were saying about a month ago before she, you know, after she'd blown her image, that she'd be a great cable talk show host.
Yeah. Oh, she'll get resurrected because she's a woman in trouble. You know, they rise to the top.
Yeah, but listen to this: they will resurrect her because they have to pretend that she was something real.
Yeah.
You know, they can't reveal that they used her, so they'll have to keep her going.
Yeah.
That's what they do with a lot of these people.
Well, let me, yeah.
They give them jobs as commentators on CNN or something.
Right. And she'll grow and mature as a person and a politician, and she'll probably find she'll probably serve some purpose in American politics, but she'll never be president. I mean, immediately after the election, they were saying, well, we're still going to run her in 2012 for, you know, the president. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, maybe that is the plan. Maybe she'll grow and supposedly grow and be a different, more wise person and be the first woman president. But I don't know what's going to happen to the Republican Party, but looks like they're pretty weak, or, you know, they're going to have a problem getting started. I don't know. So.
Yeah. No. You know what? I was disappointed when Bush won the last election, but my attitude was he and the Republican Party are going to drive themselves so far into the ground that it's going to take them a long time to come back. So let them wreck things. You know?
I mean, why do you think they're worse than the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, ultimately, I don't know. But in terms of...
ultimately, you don't know why you think they're worse.
Right, except, but, you know, on a perceptual level, first of all, I just like the image. First of all, I think the White House needs to more than represent the interests of the United States. It needs to represent the interests of the planet. And Obama looks more like a planetary human being.
No, I'm not arguing about the image. You know.
Okay, but the neoconservative thing was tied to the whole neoconservative, especially the Bush thing, was heavily tied to the Baptist religious zealot psychosis. What do we want psychosis running the planet?
Well, why did it run the planet for 20 years?
Because things were going pretty well, and people just start getting disinterested in politics, and they get interested in whatever their daily lives or what have you, and then the zealots start to here's their big chance to band together and band abortion and stand up for Jesus and do all this stuff, and they're so zealous about their cause that they're able to gather together and create energy and do what they want to do, and while everybody else is not paying attention. I think that's what happened.
And why did they start paying attention?
Because the zealots fucked everything up. They ruined the image of America in the eyes of the rest of the world, and got us into a war that's a conundrum. We can't leave. We can't stay. The financial markets are, you know, I mean.
Okay, I know that. But the thing is, I would say that they never got America in trouble. They were an appropriate response to the tribalism was happening in the rest of the world. So why wouldn't America be tribal? See, the whole tribal thing has collapsed now.
Yeah.
Looking for a universal, not in the States, for the whole world.
Yeah.
So the Republicans did not wreck the planet. They were a symptom of a global effect that was going all over the place.
No. That's a larger perspective, and I tend to, you know, agree with you. You know, I got my local perspective, and I got my larger, more global perspective, and now it's a more global perspective.
Are you speaking as a quadriphenic?
Yeah. I'm a bit of a quadriphenic, I suppose.
Everybody is.
Also, I've always thought, since I was very small, I've always thought, you know, that the inequities of the planet are just insane, and that, you know, so...
Well, everybody thinks that.
Yeah.
They may not apply to their lifestyle, but they all
right.
think that.
So on a, you know, on a global scale, especially because the internet everywhere is every place now. So how can you contain everything to, you know, say within the boundaries of the United States? It's all international politics. It's all international money. It's all international interdependence. So naturally, everything has to start caving in order to create some kind of a redistribution of life force to the planet as a whole, as opposed to it all being sucked down the drain of the United States and the Western world, while the nature goes to hell and the rest of the human race goes to hell.
Well, the media made that everybody's concern. So are we still going to be duped by the medium? Because the medium is going to prevent us being able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
There's the catch-22.
But, you know, Bush represented the last struggle against that. You know, Bush is like, damn the ecology, damn the rest of the world, damn, you know, the United States must survive, and we must stay strong, and we must stay independent, and we must take our own self-interest into, you know, and that couldn't work beyond a certain point.
So the Willows predict that, okay, the oil cartel wants to refurbish the American image, so they brought Obama in. They're going to keep the oil prices down for 6 months, you know, into the spring, summer, and then the oil prices are going to go way up.
Yeah, while the country's going bankrupt, that'll just completely bankrupt the country.
Yeah, and then they said the Dow will go to zero.
Yeah.
And they said that Bush and Cheney will be brought to their knees. You know, they will be brought to jail, brought to court, brought to punishment.
Yeah.
So that's their supposedly, or it's David's projections.
Uh-huh.
So the terrorism didn't come true. The Obama came true. We can see whether the Dow goes to zero and Bush and them are brought to trial happened. The reason they said the Dow will go to zero is that there's a fight within the Dow family, and there's a brother and a sister, and the bad one, the brother, wins. And then that drives the Dow into zero. I don't know how he influences that, but
what about the S&P?
They didn't talk about that. They just talked about the Dow.
I mean, there's two markets. There's the S&P, which are the tech stocks, and then there's the Dow.
Yeah, but they just said the Dow will go to zero.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know if
I don't know what impact that'll have on the physical economy, but it doesn't sound good.
Yeah. No, so I don't know if any of that's true. I'm just telling you what they predicted. And
I don't see how that could possibly happen, because...
Well, I don't want to go into it. It's
yeah.
their stupid prediction. There was something you just said I wanted to go into. You're saying that your that Harry Dent, you were saying yesterday, it looks pretty bad, Bob. So
yeah. Yeah, his new book is The Great Depression Ahead.
That's the title.
Yeah, but he hasn't. His predictions have been unstable for 6 months now.
Yeah,
I don't think he knows what's going on any more than anybody does.
But when you're talking to your father, you tend to believe.
Well, my dad's
within that effect. You get depressed.
Well, yeah, I do.
Of talking to your father.
Because Obama has been saying actually that the depression's coming. It's just that he was predicting it wouldn't be here for another couple, 3 years. It's happening now. And so, and for the reasons that he thinks it's going to happen, frankly, I think it's going to happen too. Bob, the only thing I think that can bail us out, because I agree with you and Jerome Corsi, is something as radical as cold fusion. And I frankly hope that it happens, but I can't. I can barely imagine it happening, but I'm pulling for it. You know, I mean, I feel like a lunatic telling people that we got to pray for cold fusion.
Yeah.
But I actually see it as the only option, the only real option. I mean, we may be able to limp around along for another 20 years the way things are going and barely feed ourselves and continue to wreck the planet, but geez.
Yeah. Now, you said Jerome Kerso. You mean that Gerald Celente?
Yeah, Gerald Celente, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like Jerome Corsi. Gerald Celente, I meant.
Is Jerome Corsi another person?
Yeah, he's a guy that I got tired of listening to.
He was on, he's a guest on?
Yeah.
But, yeah, the Celente's the guy you played me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You've got a hope. You've got hope, as Bob Carr says. You got cold fusion. You've got a strong, strong contender Dobbs out there saying that. So, lots of hope.
Yeah, hope. Well, yeah, right. Remember Nancy Parker sent that picture of Obama with a T-shirt that said hope.
Yeah. The it's funny, I quoted Nancy to Bob.
Yeah, right.
I discussed her.
I hope she hears that.
Some of these people, they don't get it. I send out Rush Limbaugh and Bob Chapman, but also there's Randy Rhodes and Paul Krugman. She says, why is Bob sending us crap? No, it's not Limbaugh. It's four people. It's the range of perspectives that I sent out. She doesn't get it.
Yeah.
She's a bit silly sometimes.
No, we got into this the last time we talked. She has a deep resentment of people who represent themselves as being authority type figures, and she thinks that you're telling everybody how it's going to be, and then you don't know any more than anybody else. I guess
I thought she liked the way I did it.
She likes you. She's fascinated. Something about you is fascinating to her and keeps her coming back for more. But she tends to dismiss
anything I'm saying.
Almost anything you say,
yeah, she likes the style. She likes the way I listen to people when I talk. And she likes the way I interact and interview people. She said that to me.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't agree with anything I say personally. Like, she doesn't believe in mediumship or any of that stuff.
No. That's why I wrote her that little note, which I included when I forwarded her message to you.
Yeah, I thought it was to me. You said, hey, drop into Portland when you're coming. I go, I'm not coming.
No, she...
It was meant for her.
Yeah, no, if you... Her. That was a response to the message that I forwarded to you, because if you read the whole thing...
Yeah, I did. I read the whole thing.
Well, she said she was...
Coming up the air.
Yeah, she said she was...
But
she may be coming up north.
When I first read it, I read her part.
Right.
I said, what do you want me to come to Portland? I'm not coming... But then I read the thing, and I realized it was her.
Yeah, and that what I had said about what I like about David Carr was in response to one of the things that she was saying in there about why she...
Yeah, you went into the mediumship and how he does not want us to...
Yeah, because her whole thing about... she's, you know, in the past, whenever you bring up mediumship or the spirit world or whatever, she denies it as being a bunch of psychosis and nonsense, and how could anybody develop belief systems around that kind of stuff. But the last time we talked, I got her to admit that whether or not we survive death or whether or not there are spirits and all this kind of stuff is a mystery. We really don't know the answer to that, and she agreed. And I said, well, I'm glad to hear you agree that, because I tend to get uptight when people say that they have the last word on these matters, and I thought that that's what you were projecting. But she was just being argumentative to what she thought you were putting out as being true.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you know, if you begin to... You know, if you begin to study Bob, you begin to recognize after a while he's very consistent in what he says, but he has these four buckets that he, you know, and I laid out the four parts, and I said in the center of it is the mystery body.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only if when you recognize that we're in the mystery body, then you can then juggle these other elements. It's not that you're putting anything out as being true. It's you're looking at the relations between things.
Yeah. And what, did you look at the YouTubes, the six YouTubes?
Yeah, those were great. I really liked them. because I had heard that show, but when I looked at the YouTubes, for some reason, the combination of the imagery and the words, it all just took it went in my perceptual matrix in a different angle.
It's a different medium. Yeah, you heard it on radio,
right?
Acoustic, and then you heard it with visuals. It's going to change your take on it.
Right, and so I experienced it differently and in a more dimensional way than I experienced it when I heard it on the radio.
Yeah, that's good. That was good effect of what he did.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that. So we'll be talking next Sunday night.
Yeah, Bob invited me to call him. I thought that was nice. I would like to talk with him. So I made
Bob Carr?
Yeah.
When did he invite you? Did I hear that?
No, it was right before I called you. No, I tried to call you on your phone and him on his phone, and I couldn't get through to you, and then you called and said, call me on Carolyn's phone.
Yeah.
So I had a moment. I talked with him for a minute, and he was very interested in speaking with me, so I'd like to do that. But what's the time difference between?
Just look up World Clock. When it's 7:30 in the at night, well, the 9:30 at night, it is 11 o'clock in the morning. So he's kind of like 12 hours ahead of you.
When it's 9:30 your time at night, my time, it's 11 a.m. his time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's 12 plus maybe an hour and a half.
Yeah.
13 and a half hours ahead of you.
Yeah.
I think that's the way it works. But you look up what's called the World Clock, and it has the times there.
From Greenwich as being the standard, or from where you're at as being the standard?
Whatever it is. If I look there now, it says it's 11:06 for Honolulu, so that's what it is. I don't know what standard. It's probably based on Greenwich standard. It's accurate.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, when I looked at the world clock for Bombay, it said it's this time in Bombay, and I said, yeah, but relative to...
What time did it say it was in Bombay?
It said it's 1:45 in Bombay right now, but I'm saying, yeah, but relative to... How many hours does that put it ahead of me? It depends. I don't know because I...
No, you go look up what it says for your time, for your place.
Oh, I see, and then you compare.
It's all the cities, you know, major cities in the world.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it says that's what it does. It lists all the... I look up Honolulu, and I look up Mumbai.
Right.
The world clock. Go for there. Okay, that's it.
So what... just one more thing. What's your experience of Bob Carr so far?
It's interesting. You know, I'm enjoying it. I sort of like the fact that we are arguing.
Yeah.
And a bit. And that's good. That's different from Gerd and Dave.
Right. Yeah, I like that too. And I think he likes it too because it gives him a little workout.
He's a teacher. He always was a teacher.
Right.
You know, and so what happens is we do a little biography, and then instead of just moving on,
right,
next phase, we go into an argument.
Right.
About things today or eternally, so that's good. I like the way it's going.
But he talks about, you know, this, you know, unbroken joyfulness that UG had.
Yeah.
But then when you listen to him, he sounds a little like, you know, he's a little complainy about the way things are. Like he hasn't quite arrived at the spontaneous, joyful, ever-present moment. He's kind of like, yeah, but life's still a bitch.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say. I think the Bob Carr we're hearing is not the Bob Carr that experiences Bob Carr.
Oh.
He's in a pretty stoned state just the way he lives, probably, but he doesn't communicate that.
Right. Like Worcester said, only 10% can get through the pipe.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the other thing is that... God damn it. What do I want to say about him? I don't know. I can't remember. It was one other comment I wanted to make.
But the thing is, it's going along good.
Yeah. So, I know what it was. You know, because he's saying human beings are just animals, Bob. That's all we are. We're just animals. But if he experienced UG as being in an unbroken state of joyful bliss, how can you say that he's just an animal?
Yeah. Well, maybe who knows what Bob means by animals? He just was a happy animal.
Yeah. Not happy, joyful.
Yeah, joyful animal.
Okay.
Okay. I would say that Bob is a little old-fashioned cliche in his statements. And within the, he's doing the Krishna Murthy meme and saying it over and over. And I'm trying to get him to see something new, or the new a new language.
Yeah, he tends to be critical. Like, for instance, he's critical of Eckhart Tolle, and so were you. And I'm critical of Eckhart Tolle for exactly the same reason. Every time I pick up a book or something like that, all I'm getting are the words that are, you know, the same words that I could have got from Ramakrishna with a twist or a, you know, a new angle or something like that. But nevertheless, if you sit in the presence of someone like Eckhart Tolle, you recognize this guy is so fucking awake from moment to moment, I can't believe my eyes. But then you try to read him through his books and through and listen to him on the radio and stuff, and you go, this isn't helping me at all.
Right. So, well, why do you think, have you sat in front of him?
No, but I've heard him live on the radio, and I've tuned in to his presence, and his presence is profound. But the thing is, as soon as I turn off the radio, I'm back in the same old dumpster of my life. It didn't make any difference. I can read his stupid books, and it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
And, you know, that came up in your conversation with him, you know. I mean, Krishnamurti didn't produce another Krishnamurti. And so, you know, what good are these teachers if they can't transmit what it is that they are?
Yeah, I can't see how Eckhart Tolle can even. I mean, I heard his voice for 5 seconds, I think, but I hardly know anything, haven't experienced him. But I can't see how anybody would think that he expresses some high evolved state unless they're subject to the Thompson meme, which is what he has done.
It's because of his presence and his sensitivity to the moment is so.
Well, you know that his words are crummy.
Well.
But
and if you but it's the same thing that you challenged Carr about what Nancy said about, well, if you read Krishnamurti and you got that he couldn't help you, why did you bother? And he said, well, we all continue to seek, but in addition to that, he said, but when you're actually in the presence of someone like that, it's not the same as reading a book.
Yeah, well, I can't believe you get a sense of presence from Eckhart Tolle as he's presented in media. Maybe if you went into his home and he experienced his chemical body, you might get that. But you haven't done that, so I don't know why you're saying.
No, I have. I got one of his seminars on a, like, this was like 3 years ago. It was like on a 10-disc CD, and I sat there and I listened to his seminar, and the guy is. You know, there's a difference between someone who's truly awake and the rest of us, which are caught up in the dream of life.
Yeah, well, I would say that framework is not valid anymore.
Well, it may not be valid in terms of being a political artist and changing the image of the world or something like that, but in terms of being able to live that way, to be able to live ecstatically and joyfully from moment to moment without being suckered by the negative emotions that the world wants us to be hypnotized by, it's a life worth living.
Yeah, but are you saying that...
Maybe it's only worth living for yourself. Maybe it doesn't translate into changing the world around you, but...
What's this political image, political artist? Are you talking about me?
Yeah, I mean, so you're trying to change the... You're trying to help to upgrade humanity's image of the world we live in.
But that's just one part of me.
Yeah.
That's my public self, or my citizen self.
Right.
No, that's not the private self.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the guy, the joyful guy that people experience when they're with me, that's... You might pick that up on my speech, but my speech doesn't emphasize that. It talks about technical things.
Yeah.
The language. So, but I don't get any sense of anything from Tolle. No, you watched a video of him or an audio?
Well, I've seen video of him, but this was an audio.
But you've seen video.
Collection.
He looks like he. You see.
I don't remember about the video. It's mostly my main experience of him is through audio presentation.
But when I hear anybody talking about enlightenment or spirituality, no, those words don't make it. You're not aware. You're not awake. You're using really like what Bob says, old art forms.
I know a number of people who've had an experience of Eckhart Tolle, and they all say, "I want what he's got," but they don't, but they can't, but he can't give it to them, and they can't get it
right.
from him.
But the point is, they want what he offers. They like his language. They don't know how obsolete his language is, and that they actually don't want what he's got. If they want real poise, they would need to adapt to the newer discussion of what's happening. Most people respond like robots to someone talking about enlightenment. That's Bob Carr's complaint too, that they are just following the old thought meme.
My experience of Toll is that he's sitting in silence. But, you know, people want him to talk, and he's got a gig, and, you know.
No,
and
when he talks, he says stuff that makes people feel comfortable and think that's the traditional replay of what a wise person used to say.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
But he hasn't turned Be Here Now into a cliche like Ram does. He is here now.
Well, I don't think it's important to be here now when now has been externalized. You know, that's the point. Nowness is not the right way to talk about where we're at. If you're trying to be here now, you're a zombie of the electric environment, which is nothing but now. It's what McLuhan called the nowness of now, is what happens when we extend the central nervous system.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't, and I know that people think in the old terms, and so if someone starts talking about now, they think, oh, that's wise. And they, if someone looks reasonably poised while they're doing it, they think, oh, that guy is heavy. No, if you knew that those words don't apply at all and that nowness is not the wisdom today, then you wouldn't even listen to him. Then you'd have to look for something else.
He doesn't say be here now. I'm just trying to express the inexpressible.
No, that's what they are. Being attentive.
But I saw something on TV yesterday that was interesting to me. It was a Visa was doing an advertising. They're talking about how, you know, Visa, we're always awake. We're always going. We're always on. We're always doing. We're always,
We're UG Krishnamurti, 24/7.
Yeah, but I remembered back in the CKLN days when you were saying, we're here to put you back to sleep because you're too awake all the time and it's driving you crazy. And that's exactly the experience I got from this Visa ad.
Yeah, but what I said made sense in relation to that.
Oh, yeah.
It was a good antivirum. That's why, you know, I mean, I'm the top guru on the planet today. And the thing is I'm the guru who doesn't stay within the guru archetypes, can be just a normal guy. Like, you'll hear me, I get the whole Fourth and James show and do a seminar. But then I'm just a co-host on Greg's show. You know, I can be all kinds of different things.
Right.
I'm not trying to get a stable Rai position of authority or awe, generating awe.
Yeah.
So, for the way I do this, I think that's pretty spectacular what I do. Especially with what I say and point out how, if you want to live in the now, you better start noticing there's four aspects of the now that are running parallel. And if you're not aware of that, then you're not in the now. You can go sit in the, it's like, that's what I say about Bob Carr. He's just complaining about the chemical body and the astral body traditions, and that he's stuck.
Right.
Worrying about those guys. Like he says, you go to a Krishnamurti or a monastery or a Catholic church or a Sufi, you aren't healed. Well, I would tell if he could understand me, well, of course they aren't healed, and that's not an issue. It's even worse than that. They think they don't even know what they have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So the futility of going to a religion, he complains about, and he's right up to that point. But what about the success of understanding the four bodies?
Right.
As opposed to just whether you made it in the monastery or not.
Right.
You know? More limited. He's only dealing with two bodies.
Yeah.
So, you know, my stuff is really involved with now. And now, as I've announced, we've moved into a new zone. We're now actually talking about the mystery body, which I never talked about before.
Yeah.
But I can talk about it because there's a joke cartoon happening all around me. That's mirroring it. That's a guy called Obama, President of the United States. No one knows whether he's an American or not. I mean, talk about a cartoon version of the mystery body. We got it.
Yeah.
That means the White House is reflecting what's deeply going on.
But why is the obsolete...
What's deeply going on?
Yeah. What is going on technologically that's creating the obsolescence of the post-information age by the mystery body... happening coincidingly with the changing of the president.
Yeah, coal fusion.
Oh, yeah, called the Hidden Ground.
What my team is doing.
Right. I like that notes that somebody posted to the McLuhan discussion list that, oh, yeah, Cold Fusion, the Hidden Ground to the Mystery Body, and then the ETs will be the Hidden Ground of the Cold Fusion.
Yeah, which is what he was quoting me. I said that.
Oh.
On one of the shows, on one of the James shows. It might have been the Wednesday show. But the point here, what was it? You're just saying... Oh, yeah, did you see... You like the one where Obama Biden means I am Bob Dean.
Oh, you know, the more I thought about it, the more that blew me away. I didn't realize that it's exactly 10 letters. I think it's the exact same. He uses every letter. I thought, oh yeah, you can get anything if you want to like pick and choose your letters, but it uses every letter.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now I can see why he thought to check that out, because you'd already been pointing out that, you know, Obama was Bob.
Yeah.
So that probably pointed him in that direction.
Who pointed him in that direction?
That probably pointed him in the direction of seeing, yeah, well, what else can I get out of this?
Yeah, it's ad absurdum. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, did you see the other post on McLuhan? The one where I explained the difference between APA and AP2 or APB? Did you see that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's elaborating in how the mystery body. I say the mystery body is surfaced because of what happened to me in October 22nd as an extension of what happened on August 26th, 08. Okay?
Which you haven't revealed yet what happened on August 26th.
No, I haven't revealed that for a long time.
Well, how long?
A couple of years.
Isn't it going to become apparent after a while?
Yeah, it'll become apparent.
Hmm. Well, what did happen to you?
Well, I'm part of we're doing it. We're actually doing it.
So it had to do with some agreement between you and the team, or something that was said, or some contracts that were signed, or...
No, we're bringing it in. We got it going.
Yeah, but what's...
Remember, I reconvened the Secret Council 10, and we're actually going to pull off what we...
But what happened on that day? Were contracts signed, or what happened? Somebody had a new thought that was a breakthrough? I mean, what happened?
No, we organized our energies.
Oh.
And then we...
formalized your organization.
No, we formalized that on October 22nd.
Uh-huh. And then on August 26th, you organized your energies.
Yeah, organized energies on August 26th, and then we formalized on October 22nd.
Right. How many we are there in this group?
Maybe we could say 10, Secret Council of 10, that's approximate.
Yeah. Well, very good.
Yeah. So you read that, I don't know, I posted it on the McLuhan thing. It's under one of the lists, I don't know. My formula complexifies. Read that in quotes, in how I distinguish now there's two kinds of AP.
Right.
Okay?
Okay, I'll go back and study it, because when I started looking at it the other night, I thought, oh my God, I barely have a grasp on what you've already been talking about, and now you're introducing another new level.
Yeah, that's right, and we can end with what Walter said. I told you what the Willow said last November, but what Walter said in May, he said my charts and all that were going to get way more complicated.
But they have to also become more simplified in order to be understood. You can't make them complicated to where they go into obscurity that nobody can ever grasp.
No, we're double. You need to understand the simple insights of life and be able to handle the complexity. That's what Finnegan's Wake's about. That's why Marshall McLuhan criticized Alan Watts. Alan Watts is too simple. He's just on the simple side. You've got to also train your perception so you can be complexified, too. You've got to do both.
Yeah. Well, what is it that you say? Amen.
Yes, amen. Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay.
Bye.
Talking to you. Bye.